is file A210857, Northeastern Minnesotans for Wilderness, respondents versus Minnesota Department of Natural Resources et al., and respondents Twin Metals, the intervener appellant in this matter. And counsel that are arguing in this matter, the DNR is not, as I understand, but available if we had questions. When you begin your statements, if you'd identify yourself for the record, we appreciate that. Also note the clock in the corner and keep an eye on that per the usual process. And no recording is allowed of this proceeding. It's prohibited, in other words, but we do have a recording, as you heard, and that will be available on the Judicial Branch website within 24 hours. Counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is John Kavinga from the law firm Larkin Hoffman. I'm counsel for Twin Metals Minnesota LLC, the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, this is an appeal from the Ramsey County District Court's order denying Twin Metals motion to dismiss and remanding the case for administrative proceedings before the DNR. Although Twin Metals has identified numerous errors in the District Court's orders, this court has said that appeal of those other issues must wait until after the entry of a final judgment. Thus, at issue in this appeal is whether the district court had jurisdiction to hear the claims of respondent Northeastern Minnesotans for Wilderness. As we will show, the answer is plainly no, because of the absence of an actual and imminent injury means respondent lacks standing and the claims are not ripe. A failure to reverse the district court and dismiss the case will significantly weaken key jurisdictional doctrines of standing and ripeness and undo decades of precedent requiring environmental challenges to be brought by the right party at the right time. I'll give a brief background of this case in which respondent challenges DNR Rule 6132, which for decades has prohibited mining activities inside the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness and a surrounding buffer zone. Twin Metals holds mining leases outside of this buffer zone and has proposed building a modern, safe, and environmentally friendly underground mine for copper, nickel, cobalt, and platinum group metals. It'll provide long-term, well-paying jobs and access to valuable metals critical to the production of clean energy, electronics, and other essentials of modern life. Your Honors, we're having this hearing today via a teleconference, a Zoom platform. That would not be possible without the metals that Twin Metals proposes to mine in this area. Nevertheless, at this stage, the mine remains essentially hypothetical. Twin Metals has submitted a proposed mine plan of operations for a scoping review, but it must complete an extensive environmental review process and receive permits from dozens of federal and state regulators after scientifically proving that it can be safely constructed and operated in compliance with all applicable environmental laws. There is no imminent risk of harm from a mine that is still years away from beginning operations if it receives all necessary approvals and in a form that remains subject to change based on environmental review and permitting.
Mr. Kavinga, doesn't that argument go to the merits? And I know there was an argument about whether a prima facie basis had been presented, but doesn't that go, that's a separate issue from the standing issue?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. Standing and ripeness are two sides of the same jurisdictional coin. And as the court is aware, a case cannot proceed without jurisdiction. That's not something that can be waived, and it's not something that can be invented through allegations in a complaint. Here, we have an issue where there is no actual and imminent injury. If the court proceeds on the case, what it would be doing is giving essentially an advisory opinion as to whether a rule is or is not inadequate based on a hypothetical set of facts that may never come to pass. That brings us really to the point about standing.
But didn't the legislature explicitly address how one gets into court under this statute? And doesn't the statute simply require that an individual or organization satisfy certain residency requirements and nothing beyond?
So I'll answer that in two parts. First, I believe it's doubtful that a statute could constitutionally eliminate the requirement of injury in fact and for a party to have standing and for a claim to be right. We cited the Lorix versus Crompton Corp case, 736 Northwest 2nd of 2007, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court noted that there are outer limits to the scope of standing that can be granted by statute, and that there are prudential limits that would, for example, not allow a statute to grant standing to any person in the state of Minnesota to sue for antitrust injuries. What respondent is suggesting in this case is that MARA does exactly that. It grants standing to anyone in the state to sue for environmental damage. Given the court's opinion in Lorix versus Crompton Corp., I don't believe that's an accurate reading of the statute.
Well, isn't the statute dealing with something that's a little different than a typical lawsuit for damages? I mean, isn't the purpose of the statute to bring something before the DNR for reconsideration of an existing rule and nothing more?
I don't believe that's accurate, Your Honor, respectfully. If it was just to bring something before the DNR, the Administrative Procedures Act provides an avenue for parties to petition for rulemaking or for review of rule. What this statute purports to do, and which is one of the issues we've raised that the court declined to review at this time, is to give the district court the ability to conduct de novo review of DNR rules that are issued under executive authority. If that's the case, there'd be constitutional separation of powers, which could render and would render the statute unconstitutional. But going back, I guess, to the first point about the statute itself says that it allows a challenge where an environmental rule is inadequate to protect the air, water, land, or other natural resources from pollution, impairment, or destruction. And pollution, impairment, and destruction is statutorily defined to be conduct which materially adversely affects or is likely to materially adversely affect the environment. I'd submit that statutory language incorporates a very real injury in fact, an actual or imminent injury requirement in order for the statute to be invoked and for standing to be found for a party to bring a challenge.
So are you suggesting that we can simply look to the language of the statute and not to other sources of a standing requirement, such as an Article 3, you know, requirement under the federal constitution?
I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying that one part of it is looking at the statute. The other part, as you've identified, is that, for example, the United States Constitution, Article 3, has an actual case and controversy requirement. I believe the Minnesota Constitution should be read the same way, and Minnesota precedent is read the same way, to require some level of ripeness, some level of standing, some connection to an injury that is redressable, and does not allow simply purely speculative and hypothetical challenges to statutes. And at the stage we are now, that is exactly what this would be. The allegations concern something that might happen if a mine is granted approval after environmental review. It is not ripe, and therefore there's no standing, there's no jurisdiction, and the case should have been dismissed.
Mr. Kavingi, how do you square that with, there appears to be I'll describe it as a broadening of standing in public interest cases in Minnesota, and the Northfield, City of Northfield case seemed to summarize that using the language, the injury in fact, as you're talking about, or a legislative authorization, I believe is the word. And that follows and cites to about 10 years earlier case, which then cites to a case, I can't remember if it goes back into the 70s. So the point, how do you respond to that? That seems to be, since we're an error correcting court, our most direct authority, which has already identified this as a public interest exception to the law you're now citing that would otherwise exist. How do you respond to that?
Yes, I think it's important to keep both standing and ripeness in mind. If a statute is allowed to eliminate the requirement of injury for standing, that just says anyone can sue for what would be essentially an advisory opinion, at a certain point, that dilution and weakening of standing creates the ripeness issues, which the, as far as I am aware, the Minnesota Supreme Court has never said can be eliminated by standing. At this early stage of the process, the claims are simply not ripe to proceed at that point.
So if I understand correctly, are you indicating that what's, if I understand your interpretation of that case law, that the public interest only exists if indeed the public, whatever the statutory authorization is at some level met. And so that's why you tie it back into the showing of conduct in order to show there's a public interest, which then allows for this, the legislative grant of standing. Am I following the dots?
I believe that's a fair summary. I don't think we would concede that a plaintiff need not show a particularized injury, but even if that were the case, I think the elements of ripeness and justiciability would require the plaintiff to be able to show that at least some, the environment is being damaged, that there is some actual and imminent risk in general, even if it's not particularized to that particular plaintiff.
Counsel, how do you get around the League of Women Voters case where the court basically said that or suggests that when Minnesota law does not require an injury in fact, because the legislature has broadly granted statutory standing without showing more, how do you distinguish that case from what we have here?
So I think in the League of Women Voters case, we had a situation where there was an actual and imminent injury. The Supreme Court found it unnecessary to reach the question of whether those particular plaintiffs had damage, but the actions being complained of were currently ongoing. Compare that to our case here, where we have a rule that has been in place for decades, and there is a hypothetical concern and fear on behalf of the plaintiffs that if it's not changed, a mine could receive permits and begin operations, which could, through some unspecified means, result in harm outside of the location of the mine. So I think I would also refer back to the Lorix versus Crompton case, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court said that there must be outer limits to the scope of standing that can be granted by statute. There must be prudential limits to avoid just opening the floodgates to anyone to sue, even if they're unconnected to the actual dispute at issue. I'd also like to focus on the constitutional issues created if the district court's order is allowed to stand and the jurisdictional requirements of standing and ripeness are weakened or eliminated. If anyone can bring a MIRA claim at any time, regardless of whether they suffer an individualized harm, and regardless of whether there's an actual or imminent threat to the environment, this court would open the floodgates to allow hypothetical challenges to rules and judicial override of the decisions of the legislative and executive branches. MIRA is intended to prevent environmental harm, not provide an avenue for issuing advisory opinions or resolving political questions in the courts. In eliminating the requirement of standing and ripeness and granting itself the right to a de novo review of any decision rendered by the DNR, the district court did exactly what Justice Anderson said would be unconstitutional in the White Bear Lake Restoration Association versus DNR case. For that reason, the district court decision must be reversed and the case dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
Mr. Kavingi, can you just distinguish for me as it applies to this case, ripeness versus jurisdiction? I'm interested more in your distinction of that than the standing, I'm sorry.
Sure. You want ripeness and standing distinguished?
Well, yes, it would apply in this scenario, and would it make a difference? Would the result as you would request be the same?
I'll take it this way. The concept of jurisdiction has many elements to it. The two we're focusing on here are standing and ripeness. We cited a case in our briefs, which I can't put my finger on at the moment, but where the Minnesota Supreme Court evaluated a challenge to standing, and in the course of that evaluation said, we don't really think standing is applicable because of the statute, but that still brings us to the issue of ripeness. Is this case properly before the court at this time? So standing is the question of who can bring a claim. And that under Article 3 has both an injury component and also the individual. Ripeness is when the claim can be brought.
I just want to bring you back to the special term order of this court. And the court determined that the appeal was properly before us just on the issue of standing. Are we even in a position to consider the ripeness issue, or are you sort of just folding that in? And trying to get review of that where we haven't explicitly permitted that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The court granted review to determine whether the district court had jurisdiction. And really, when you focus on the gravamen of the issue, rather than the terminology, the question is there an injury that is redressable by the court? We characterized it through the lens of standing, but it's equally applicable through ripeness. And it presents the same jurisdictional issues that allow an immediate appeal from the denial of a motion to dismiss. And I don't think this is a situation where we are springing a new concept on the court or on respondents. The issue is and has always been, that there is no current actual and imminent injury to support the claim. And what has changed is that on appeal for the first time, the respondent said that statutory standing can eliminate the requirement of injury, which is not true, because then you run into the issues with ripeness, which we raised and identified in our reply and in the case law. And if there are no further questions, I see my time has expired.
And you'll have 5 minutes, Mr. Cavingi, on rebuttal. And so, counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself, then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Heather McElroy. I'm an attorney with Cerisi Conlin, and I'm here today representing respondent, Northeastern Minnesotans for Wilderness. It's now been twice in, say, the past 2 years that the Minnesota Supreme Court has explicitly rejected attempts to engraft limitations on the plain language of the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act. Once in the White Bear Lake Restoration Association decision, and also more recently in Smart Growth. And yet here we are again, now with Twin Metals trying to engraft additional limitations, this time with respect to standing. And I do want, as you pointed out, Your Honors, that standing is the single issue on which this court accepted jurisdiction. The May 12th, 2021 order, the order on jurisdiction that this court issued stated, quote, that they accepted jurisdiction over the portion of the May 12th, 2021 order denying Twin Metals a motion to dismiss for lack of standing. Jurisdiction was disputed, the parties briefed it, and the basis for accepting jurisdiction was likening standing to subject matter jurisdiction. And so that was the issue really that this court accepted review on. So focusing on standing really asks the fundamental question, who can bring an action, right? And to answer that question, we look no further than the language of the statute in 116B.10 that provides that any organization with members residing in the state can bring a civil action to challenge the adequacy of a rule to protect a natural resource from pollution, impairment, or destruction. And that is a mouthful, but the point is that that isn't contested, right? Twin Metals doesn't contest that NMW is such an organization, and the district court's order can be affirmed on that ground alone. But again, even if this court were to say, yes, you need some injury in fact, the respondent here has amply met that as well, and that would be an alternative basis on which to affirm the district court order. The key here, and you've pointed this out with your questions, is that in Minnesota, it's different than federal law, and standing can be conferred by statute. And that's something that was determined in a series of cases dating back many, many years by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And MIRA contains a particularly expansive grant of statutory standing.
Ms. McElroy, can I ask you, do you see a distinction between a statutory cause of action and standing? It seems to be your argument is because the statute, which it does, of course, and that we're here, identifies a basis that you tie that in directly to standing. And yet it seems like the public interest cases that did refer to statutes did refer to language such as one who is aggrieved, for instance, and those statutes therefore had kind of a standing component because it required some level of an injury implicit in the statute. This one is silent, at least as to standing. It does describe pollution causing needs to that a petitioner needs to prove. And so I'm trying to understand the distinction. And the point I'm getting at is the case law that talks about that. When you refer to, you look at each one of those cases, there seems to be some statutory language that has some sort of an injury inherent in the language. Whereas here, the only language that refers to injury is the merits obligation. And therefore, it almost seems like they're somewhat tied together. But is your point being is any statute that simply has a cause of action, one has standing?
That point here is that MIRA's language is unique, frankly, and it's similar to what you see in League of Women Voters, which didn't have, it had any person, not any aggrieved person or any injured, person with an injury like you had in Lorix, right? So those statutes are very different, and ours is much more akin to League of Women Voters, where the court decided, yeah, you can have a statute that gives standing to any person. And that is, quote, a clear legislative grant authorizing any person to bring suit regardless of a showing of actual harm. But to your point, Your Honor, yes, of course, ultimately, the respondent needs to allege and prove an injury to the Boundary Waters. There's no doubt, but that is a merits issue, not a standing issue. And that's the big distinction that you have with MIRA. And that was frankly the point when MIRA was enacted, was that standing had been a hurdle in environmental cases. And pre-MIRA, you had to rely on nuisance law and to bring environmental cases. And that was, the standing posed a hurdle under that cause of action. So MIRA was enacted to place the responsibility and duty on each of us as citizens of Minnesota to have standing to go into court and to protect our natural resources. But again, there absolutely is an ultimate burden of proof that in a Section 10 case, respondent carries. It's just a matter of the merits. And maybe a good way to explain this is really to focus on the Schaller cases, because I think that's a really good distinction, because I think you've hit at the heart of what is going on here, which is like, where is that line between standing and the merits? And, you know, our view is that Twin Metals continues to conflate those in a way that's simply not accurate. So, you know, in the Schaller cases, you had Schaller sued the county of Blue Earth, complaining about noise from a planned highway expansion, and the county challenged standing, arguing that Schaller's land was not even among the parcels that were subject to a noise violation and there could be no injury. But the court found that for standing under MIRA, it just didn't matter because MIRA expressly confers standing on any person residing in the state, and that person doesn't need to be injured. Now, ultimately, although Schaller had standing and that issue was resolved simply as a matter of plain language of the statute, the Court of Appeals affirmed dismissal of a significant portion of that claim, and it couldn't go forward. Why? Because it was too speculative, premature, and minimal, and it related to conduct 14 years away. And there were too many contingencies, exactly the kind of arguments the Twin Metals is making throughout their brief. And the point, though, is that all of that related to the prima facie case. So yes, you know, Schaller's claim was too speculative and premature, but that didn't mean he lacked standing to bring the case. He surely did. His environmental injuries were just too speculative to prevail. And so the distinction is so important in MIRA that standing doesn't, you know, in some actions, depending on the statute, standing might be your hurdle, but it really isn't here, and that was intentional. But there are still guardrails, and I think that's an important point to keep in mind, that these arguments about, you know, a slippery slope and we're going to end up, you know, going down this road of having all these different advisory opinions, that's not the case. We have guardrails in Section 116B.10, and frankly, MIRA's prima facie standard is what serves that gatekeeping role. So once an action has been brought and once someone comes into court, they have to, you know, put up or shut up pretty quickly and be able to present a prima facie case of the existence of material evidence that the challenge rule is inadequate to protect the natural resource in question.
Ms. McElroy, can I ask you a question about that? And I realize because of the special term, we're limited to the standing, although the argument, of course, has to do with the injury. And when you reference the prima facie basis, my understanding is that that was essentially reached by stipulation. And so I assume, and the special term, of course, noted that Mr. Cavigni's client will have opportunity later, which I suspect they will take full advantage of. But I only raise that issue because we're still early on. But isn't it true, therefore, that your client did not present any evidence to the court to make a finding other than the standing allegations that were responded to? And so, therefore, there was no real guardrail that you're referring to that went on because it was stipulated to, and the court simply accepted the stipulation.
Well, in response to that, Your Honor, you know, this wasn't a complaint that just minimally passed the notice pleading standards. I mean, it was 67 pages long, replete with a number of allegations of harm and injury, cites to governmental studies, technical studies, an appendix of documents attached to, you know, a 2016 letter from the federal government. That went on, you know, making the conclusion that sulfide or copper mining would be unacceptable in the Rainy River headwaters because of the inherent risk to the boundary waters. And that itself was lengthy, 20 some pages. So, on the one hand, I think the first answer to that is there absolutely is, you know, a burden of production here. And frankly, the DNR, is the entity for whom that prima facie standard is, you know, designed to protect, took a look at all of that and said, you know, it's not in the public interest to fight over this low bar that we've got on prima facie. There's clearly a mountain of evidence here. There's no doubt that Twin Metals is going to dispute that. And we're going to get a really, really great record because there's clearly a very distinct controversy. And therefore, given that low bar, said it's not worth it. It's okay. We're fine with going ahead and proceeding with the remand. And, you know, the district court considered that evidence in our order and considered those arguments, found that the standard was, you know, fairly low and that Twin Metals' arguments were not well taken in that regard, given that mountain of evidence. And I don't want to spend, you know, too much time on injury in fact, because, you know, our position, and I think it's quite clear, is that in Minnesota, statutory standing is sufficient. And in that case, you shouldn't even get to an injury in fact requirement. And with MIRA, we don't want to be reading injury in fact or implying that that analysis should be read into standing, because according to the statute, it shouldn't. That said, NMW.
So I'm just gonna stop you there, Ms. McElroy. So to that extent, do you agree that the district court erred, therefore, in jumping to that step of the analysis and discussing whether there was and concluding that there was an injury in fact here sufficient to establish standing?
So I don't want to say that, honestly, that it was an error. I think it's an alternative basis, but I think it may not be the best or most, the most direct and accurate way to analyze standing.
It was kind of a trick question, I'll give you that. A difficult one to answer diplomatically, but I think I understand your point.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not a necessary analysis to get to. And I think it can, you know, provide further support. Absolutely. Look, I mean, we had the allegations. We had so many members who were going to suffer, you know, concrete economic, aesthetic, and environmental harms that we thought, you know, why not get that in there in light of Justice Anderson's comments in the dissent in White Bear Lake and to create that record worst case scenario, right? And they're in there. And they're absolutely are established. And I think, you know, one key thing that we keep hearing from Twin Metals is that, there is more that needs to be done, right? That this is an abstract controversy because we don't know, you know, all of the facts that we need to know. And I think this is what really gets to what they're saying on ripeness. And I want to be clear, at this stage of the case, you have to credit the allegations in the amended complaint, right? I mean, that's where we are here. And what that complaint alleges is that the critical aspects of this project, you know, that fix the likelihood of injury to the boundary waters and the imminence of that injury, they're already known and they're not dependent on any subsequent environmental review, right? We know the location of the mineral leases, where they are in the Rainy River headwaters adjacent to the boundary waters. We know where the minerals are. So even if the leases weren't there, the minerals are where the minerals are, and we know that they want them. We know about the toxic tailings pile, and we know that's part of their plan. And current science teaches, and we now know about the interconnectivity of the waters, the surface water and the groundwater between those headwaters and the way they flow north directly into the boundary waters and beyond. And because of that, we are certain that should pollution get into the Rainy River headwaters, it is absolutely going into the boundary waters. And the DNR has previously made a decision that we are going to protect the boundary waters no matter what from this kind of mining. And yet now suddenly we can get around that by simply putting a mine at its edges. And that's why these rules are inadequate. And it's also key that you can't, there's no technology known today that can stop this, sulfide, the acid mine drainage from leaching and ultimately traveling into the boundary waters. We don't have that technology. And because the boundary waters are an area where we lack a lot of infrastructure and roads, we're not able to reclaim or remediate. So finally, I only have a few seconds left here, but you know, I think overall what we're seeing is that Twin Metals has made some arguments that somehow it's both too early and too late to bring this action, that somehow they've spent both too much, $450 million on this mine, and yet too little for it to constitute a legitimate threat to the boundary waters. And they're using mirror case law on the merits in order to try to import a standing restriction into the mirror statute that simply isn't there. And that analysis is wrong. And so the order of the district court denying Twin Metals' motion to dismiss for lack of standing should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Cavini, you now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. As soon as you see the clock, there it is. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. We've heard a lot about speculative harm that might occur if a mine is eventually granted approval, and if that results in pollution, and if that enters the water, and if that enters the boundary waters, but nothing about harm that is currently ongoing or imminent in the near future. And MIRA is not meant to address hypothetical injuries. The courts are not meant to address hypothetical injuries. The absence of harm that is actual and imminent means the absence of jurisdiction. And there was a brief discussion about the prima facie standard, and that's the district court's shortcuts, which were part of the stipulation from the DNR and respondent, are part of the reason we're in this very odd situation where the DNR chose not to defend its rules and entered into a stipulation with the plaintiff and said, we'll skip the prima facie step. But jurisdiction cannot be established by stipulation. And so because there was never an opportunity to challenge the allegations beyond what they say on their face, there's never an opportunity to develop the record and establish the absence of jurisdiction more than we already did. And so for respondent to now say that we can't get into whether the injury is ripe or not, because you have to take all of the allegations as true, and the district court took all these shortcuts, ignores the fact that, again, you cannot create jurisdiction by stipulation. That simply doesn't work. That's how we get advisory opinions from the court, which are clearly prohibited. What we're seeing here is attempt at continued erosion of the jurisdictional requirements for environmental claims. And they use the example of White Bear Lake and Smart Growth as showing that that the requirement of harm has been removed or weakened. But I don't believe that's true. In White Bear Lake Restoration Association, the issue was whether DNR pumping permits were affecting lake levels currently. It was a current ongoing harm. In Smart Growth, the issue was whether the City of Minneapolis's comprehensive plan would allow immediate build out and upzoning of areas and what the environmental impact of that. Both of those cases are talking about current imminent harm in the near future. The Minnesota Supreme Court interpreting MIRA has never said that a hypothetical harm years in the future that may never come to fruition is a sufficient ground for action and a sufficient ground to establish standing. On the contrary, we've cited numerous MIRA case laws, including Schaller and the others, which say that claims were too speculative, too hypothetical, too dependent on events that could or could not happen in the future. That's exactly the situation we have here.
Mr. Cavini, am I correct in terms of if we were to affirm the district court, this court had authority to issue a temporary injunction, but did not do that. And I assume in part, at least I didn't see that, because of the preliminary nature, as you've described it, of the entire project. Am I to understand that while the rulemaking analysis occurs, that all the environmental studies and other processes permitting will continue ongoing unabated by the district court's decision?
That is, the district court was not asked to enter an injunction at that stage. Certainly, we wouldn't believe that one is appropriate. But you are correct that the permitting process, environmental review, those backwards environmental review, then the permitting process are ongoing and will continue. But in the meantime, we are also left with the uncertainty of what DNR Rule 6132 looks like, and having to expend resources, and the state having to expend resources for that matter, on an extensive review process for hypothetical harms. I don't believe that's what the legislature intended when it enacted MIRA. And I don't believe it is constitutional what the courts can allow to happen, given the requirements for jurisdiction. So I guess turning this back, we have a requirement for actual and imminent injury. It doesn't have to be happening currently necessarily, but at least in the near future, that there's something concrete and non-speculative to require immediate action. And the plaintiff's complaint doesn't establish that. We haven't heard anything in oral argument today that establishes an actual and imminent injury. This is all based on future speculative harms that may not occur. That is insufficient to confer jurisdiction over the district court. And the district court erred when it failed to dismiss the complaint on that ground. That decision should be reversed and the case should be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today, as well as your briefing, and a great tutorial for us into standing as well that we all could use a refresher on. So thank you both. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. Have a great day.
Thank you.